Chapter 3. "But, Mr. Jennings," apostrophe said Nicholas Tulrumble, "he'll be suffocated." Apostrophe, "I'm very sorry for it, sir," apostrophe replied Mr. Jennings. "But nobody can get that armor off without his own assistance. I'm quite certain of it from the way he put it on." Apostrophe, here Ned wept dolefully, and shook his helmeted head, in a manner that might have touched a heart of stone. But the crowd had not hearts of stone, and they laughed heartily. "Dear me, Mr. Jennings," apostrophe said Nicholas, turning pale at the possibility of Ned's being smothered in his antique costume. "Dear me, Mr. Jennings, can nothing be done with him?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Nothing at all," apostrophe replied Ned, "nothing at all. Gentlemen, I'm an unhappy wretch. I'm a body, gentlemen, in a brass coffin." Apostrophe, at this poetical idea of his own conjuring up, Ned cried so much that the people began to get sympathetic and to ask what Nicholas Tulrumble meant by putting a man into such a machine as that. And one individual in a hairy waistcoat like the top of a trunk, who had previously expressed his opinion that if Ned hadn't been a poor man, Nicholas wouldn't have dared do it, hinted at the propriety of breaking the four-wheel chaise, or Nicholas's head, or both, which last compound proposition the crowd seemed to consider a very good notion. It was not acted upon, however, for it had hardly been broached, when Ned Twigger's wife made her appearance abruptly in the little circle before noticed, and Ned no sooner caught a glimpse of her face and form, than from the mere force of habit he set off towards his home just as fast as his legs could carry him. And that was not very quick in the present instance either, for, however ready they might have been to carry him, they couldn't get on very well under the brass armor. So, Mrs. Twigger had plenty of time to denounce Nicholas Tulrumble to his face, to express her opinion that he was a decided monster, and to intimate that, if her ill-used husband sustained any personal damage from the brass armor, she would have the law of Nicholas Tulrumble for manslaughter. When she had said all this with due vehemence, she posted after Ned, who was dragging himself along as best he could, and deploring his unhappiness in most dismal tones. What a wailing and screaming Ned's children raised when he got home at last! Mrs. Twigger tried to undo the armor, first in one place, and then in another, but she couldn't manage it, so she tumbled Ned into bed, helmet, armor, gauntlets, and all. Such a creaking as the bedstead made, under Ned's weight in his new suit. It didn't break down though, and there Ned lay, like the anonymous vessel in the Bay of Biscay, till next day, drinking barley water, and looking miserable. And every time he groaned, his good lady said it served him right, which was all the consolation Ned Twigger got. Nicholas Tulrumble and the gorgeous procession went on together to the town hall, amid the hisses and groans of all the spectators, who had suddenly taken it into their heads to consider poor Ned a martyr. Nicholas was formally installed in his new office, in acknowledgement of which ceremony he delivered himself of a speech, composed by the secretary, which was very long, and no doubt very good, only the noise of the people outside prevented anybody from hearing it, but Nicholas Tulrumble himself. After which, the procession got back to Mudfog Hall anyhow it could, and Nicholas and the corporation sat down to dinner. But the dinner was flat, and Nicholas was disappointed. They were such dull, sleepy old fellows, that corporation. Nicholas made quite as long speeches as the Lord Mayor of London had done, nay, he said the very same things that the Lord Mayor of London had said, and the deuce a cheer the corporation gave him. There was only one man in the party who was thoroughly awake, and he was insolent, and called him Nick. Nick! What would be the consequence, thought Nicholas, of anybody presuming to call the Lord Mayor of London Nick? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he should like to know what the sword bearer would say to that, or the recorder, or the toastmaster, or any other of the great officers of the city. They'd nick him. But these were not the worst of Nicholas Tulrumble's doings. If they had been, he might have remained a mayor to this day, and have talked till he lost his voice. He contracted a relish for statistics, and got philosophical, and the statistics and the philosophy together led him into an act which increased his unpopularity and hastened his downfall. At the very end of the Mudfog High Street, and abutting on the riverside, stands the Jolly Boatman, an old-fashioned low-roofed, bay-windowed house, with a bar, kitchen, and tap room all in one, and a large fireplace with a kettle to correspond, round which the working men have congregated time out of mind on a winter's night, refreshed by draughts of good strong beer, and cheered by the sounds of a fiddle and tambourine. The Jolly Boatman having been duly licensed by the mayor and corporation to scrape the fiddle and thumb the tambourine from time, whereof the memory of the oldest inhabitants goeth not to the contrary. Now Nicholas Tulrumble had been reading pamphlets on crime and parliamentary reports, or had made the secretary read them to him, which is the same thing in effect, and he at once perceived that this fiddle and tambourine must have done more to demoralize Mudfog than any other operating causes that ingenuity could imagine. So he read up for the subject, and determined to come out on the corporation with a burst, the very next time the license was applied for. The licensing day came, and the red-faced landlord of the Jolly Boatman walked into the town hall, looking as jolly as need be, having actually put on an extra fiddle for that night, to commemorate the anniversary of the Jolly Boatman's music license. It was applied for in due form, and was just about to be granted as a matter of course, when up rose Nicholas Tulrumble, and drowned the astonished corporation in a torrent of eloquence. He descanted in glowing terms upon the increasing depravity of his native town of Mudfog, and the excesses committed by its population. Then, he related how shocked he had been to see barrels of beer sliding down into the cellar of the Jolly Boatman week after week, and how he had sat at a window opposite the Jolly Boatman for 2 days together, to count the people who went in for beer between the hours of 12 and 1 o'clock alone, which, by the by, was the time at which the great majority of the Mudfog people dined. Then, he went on to state how the number of people who came out with beer jugs averaged 21 in 5 minutes, which, being multiplied by 12, gave 252 people with beer jugs in an hour, and multiplied again by 15, the number of hours during which the house was open daily, yielded 3,780 people with beer jugs per day, or 26,460 people with beer jugs per week. Then he proceeded to show that a tambourine and moral degradation were synonymous terms, and a fiddle and vicious propensities wholly inseparable. All these arguments he strengthened and demonstrated by frequent references to a large book with a blue cover, and sundry quotations from the Middlesex magistrates. And in the end, the corporation, who were posed with the figures, and sleepy with the speech, and sadly in want of dinner into the bargain, yielded the palm to Nicholas Tulrumble, and refused the music license to the Jolly Boatman. But although Nicholas triumphed, his triumph was short. He carried on the war against beer jugs and fiddles, forgetting the time when he was glad to drink out of the one, and to dance to the other, till the people hated, and his old friends shunned him. He grew tired of the lonely magnificence of Mudfog Hall, and his heart yearned towards the Lighterman's Arms. He wished he had never set up as a public man, and sighed for the good old times of the coal shop, and the chimney corner. At length old Nicholas, being thoroughly miserable, took heart of grace, paid the secretary a quarter's wages in advance, and packed him off to London by the next coach. Having taken this step, he put his hat on his head, and his pride in his pocket, and walked down to the old room at the Lighterman's Arms. There were only two of the old fellows there, and they looked coldly on Nicholas as he proffered his hand. Are you going to put down pipes, Mr. Tolrumble? Apostrophe apostrophe said one. Or trace the progress of crime to Bacca. Apostrophe apostrophe growled another. Neither, apostrophe replied Nicholas Tolrumble, shaking hands with them both, whether they would or not. I've come down to say that I'm very sorry for having made a fool of myself, and that I hope you'll give me up the old chair again. Apostrophe, the old fellows opened their eyes, and three or four more old fellows opened the door, to whom Nicholas, with tears in his eyes, thrust out his hand to, and told the same story. They raised a shout of joy that made the bells in the ancient church tower vibrate again, and wheeling the old chair into the warm corner, thrust old Nicholas down into it, and ordered in the very largest sized bowl of hot punch, with an unlimited number of pipes, directly. The next day, the jolly boatman got the license, and the next night, old Nicholas and Ned Twigger's wife led off a dance to the music of the fiddle and tambourine, the tone of which seemed mightily improved by a little rest, for they never had played so merrily before. Ned Twigger was in the very height of his glory, and he danced hornpipes, and balanced chairs on his chin, and straws on his nose, till the whole company, including the corporation, were in raptures of admiration at the brilliancy of his acquirements. Mr. Tolrumble, Jr., couldn't make up his mind to be anything but magnificent, so he went up to London, and drew bills on his father, and when he had overdrawn, and got into debt, he grew penitent, and came home again. As to old Nicholas, he kept his word, and having had 6 weeks of public life, never tried it any more. He went to sleep in the town hall at the very next meeting, and, in full proof of his sincerity, has requested us to write this faithful narrative. We wish it could have the effect of reminding the Tolrumbles of another sphere, that puffed up conceit is not dignity, and that snarling at the little pleasures they were once glad to enjoy, because they would rather forget the times when they were of lower station, renders them objects of contempt and ridicule. This is the first time we have published any of our gleanings from this particular source. Perhaps, at some future period, we may venture to open the Chronicles of Mudfog. Full report of the first meeting of the Mudfog Association for the Advancement of Everything. We have made the most unparalleled and extraordinary exertions to place before our readers a complete and accurate account of the proceedings at the late grand meeting of the Mudfog Association, holden in the town of Mudfog. It affords us great happiness to lay the result before them in the shape of various communications received from our able, talented, and graphic correspondent, expressly sent down for the purpose, who has immortalized us, himself, Mudfog, and the association, all at one and the same time. We have been, indeed, for some days unable to determine who will transmit the greatest name to posterity, ourselves, who sent our correspondent down, our correspondent, who wrote an account of the matter, or the association, who gave our correspondent something to write about. We rather incline to the opinion that we are the greatest man of the party, inasmuch as the notion of an exclusive and authentic report originated with us. This may be prejudice. It may arise from a prepossession on our part in our own favor. Be it so. We have no doubt that every gentleman concerned in this mighty assemblage is troubled with the same complaint in a greater or less degree, and it is a consolation to us to know that we have at least this feeling in common with the great scientific stars, the brilliant and extraordinary luminaries, whose speculations we record. We give our correspondents' letters in the order in which they reached us. Any attempt at amalgamating them into one beautiful whole would only destroy that glowing tone, that dash of wildness, and rich vein of picturesque interest, which pervade them throughout. Mudfog, Monday night, 7 o'clock. We are in a state of great excitement here. Nothing is spoken of, but the approaching meeting of the association. The indoors are thronged with waiters anxiously looking for the expected arrivals, and the numerous bills which are wafered up in the windows of private houses, intimating that there are beds to let within, give the streets a very animated and cheerful appearance, the wafers being of a great variety of colors, and the monotony of printed inscriptions being relieved by every possible size and style of handwriting. It is confidently rumored that Professor Snore, Doze, and Wheezy have engaged three beds, and a sitting room at the Pig and Tinder Box. I give you the rumor as it has reached me, but I cannot, as yet, vouch for its accuracy. The moment I have been enabled to obtain any certain information upon this interesting point, you may depend upon receiving it. ~7:30. I have just returned from a personal interview with the landlord of the Pig and Tinder Box. He speaks confidently of the probability of Professor Snore, Doze, and Wheezy taking up their residence at his house during the sitting of the association, but denies that the bets have been yet engaged, in which representation he is confirmed by the chambermaid, a girl of artless manners and interesting appearance. The Boots denies that it is at all likely that Professor Snore, Doze, and Wheezy will put up here, but I have reason to believe that this man has been suborned by the proprietor of the original Pig, which is the opposition hotel. Amidst such conflicting testimony, it is difficult to arrive at the real truth, but you may depend upon receiving authentic information upon this point the moment the fact is ascertained. The excitement still continues. A boy fell through the window of the pastry cook's shop at the corner of the high street about half an hour ago, which has occasioned much confusion. The general impression is that it was an accident. Pray heaven it may prove so. ~Tuesday, noon. At an early hour this morning the bells of all the churches struck 7 o'clock, the effect of which, in the present lively state of the town, was extremely singular. While I was at breakfast, a yellow gig, drawn by a dark gray horse, with a patch of white over his right eyelid, proceeded at a rapid pace in the direction of the original Pig stables. It is currently reported that this gentleman has arrived here for the purpose of attending the association, and, from what I have heard, I consider it extremely probable, although nothing decisive is yet known regarding him. You may conceive the anxiety with which we are all looking forward to the arrival of the 4 o'clock coach this afternoon. Notwithstanding the excited state of the populace, no outrage has yet been committed, owing to the admirable discipline and discretion of the police, who are nowhere to be seen. A barrel organ is playing opposite my window, and groups of people, offering fish and vegetables for sale, parade the streets. With these exceptions everything is quiet, and I trust will continue so. ~5:00. It is now ascertained, beyond all doubt, that Professor Snore, Doze, and Wheezy will not repair to the Pig and Tinder Box, but have actually engaged apartments at the original Pig. This intelligence is exclusive, and I leave you and your readers to draw their own inferences from it. Why Professor Wheezy, of all people in the world, should repair to the original Pig in preference to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.